The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. Q&A edition is where we're at today. We're recording this in preparation for release immediately after the 4th of July. We'll release on the 5th, so we normally record a day before. We're recording 2 days before, since we'll all be out doing things celebrating Independence Day. But other than that, it'll be a pretty standard Q&A show. Jim, let me know, as usual. We'll have a couple Social Security questions to deal with, and then kind of a mixed bag. We are now into July, so while annuity questions might come up, it won't be such an annuity-dominated show, since we have now exited Annuity Awareness Month, which happens every June. So, yeah, that's where we're at. Nice and toasty here in Colorado. Good to be outside if you like the nice weather. My grass doesn't like it, but that's okay. My grass doesn't have feelings. I'd rather have the weather be happy for humans than to prioritize grass. So, Jim, your garden holding up, I'm sure, and you're going to get plenty of time to work in the garden this weekend with an extra day.
True, and plus I have no life, so that's all I'll do. Mm-hmm. No, we might go hiking on Saturday up in Rocky Mountain National Park, but it means me having to get up at 4:30, so I'm not quite sure.
Ouch. Well, because you don't want to hike in the heat of the day.
No, because we don't have a timed entry, so we have to get there before the park opens.
And you have to beat them, beat the crowd.
Yep. Yep. The wonderful part of living back in Colorado, they do this timed entry now to get into the national parks, so never had to worry about this. But anyways, we'll decide. If we go, it'll be on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I have no major plans except working in the yard. As far as my garden, I'm just amazed at how fast things dry out. I had everything so watered yesterday. And again, that's the dry, arid climate, folks. Unless you're here to see how fast things dry, it's amazing. But yeah, it's making it. It's as long as they keep putting water on it, as long as they don't put water restrictions. They have, I guess you could call them restrictions. I'm only allowed to water 3 or 4 days a week. I forget. I have it marked down on my calendars the days I can water. It depends if I'm on the odd number or even number side of the street. But it's at the lowest level of the lowest is no restriction, so I'm at one level. It goes up to, I think, 3 or 4.
Yeah.
We do it differently than Fort Collins. Fort Collins is on a 3-day water restriction, I know, so we can only water the office 3 days. And I went in there yesterday. I don't know when was the last time you were in the office, but I was in Ohio for the past week. I went in yesterday, and there's this nice dead spot, pretty big dead section, not spot, of grass. And I said to Joe, I'm like, have you guys noticed this thing dying? And she's like, well, I don't think water's getting on it. And I guess I had to be the brilliant one to say, did you guys check the sprinkler system to make sure this zone is working? So once I put the idea in their head, they checked it this morning and they found, guess what?
Either a broken head or it just doesn't work.
That zone doesn't work. So I had to tell them to do what, you think?
Call the landscaper person.
There you go. The wonderful part of owning rental property, well, I own it. No, it's mine, but I guess I'm the landlord of myself, where you have to kind of say, well, I think we should call someone. I think we need to check the water. But Joe did a good job. I got to give Joe credit. She did, and she got it set. She texted me that her sprinkler guy is going to come check it out, but that's why we have a dead spot in our yard, in case you haven't noticed.
Yeah,
Jake's coming out here next week. I know he listens. So, Jake, you will see the said dead spot of which I speak.
I bet he's going to look forward to that.
Yeah, he's going to fly all the way out from Alaska. Not Alaska. Oh, he's in Chicago. He's going to fly all the way out from Chicago to see the dead spot in the office grass. But Jake, you guys know him. He's been on the show many times. He is coming out to Colorado for a little mini vacation, and he's going to stop in the office for a day or so next week. So that'll be nice to see him. I don't think we've seen him in a couple of years, right?
It's been a while. That's for sure. At least a year.
It's been a couple of years. Maybe longer. I spoke to Greg today. Greg wants to come out. He didn't want to come out this year, but he said he'll come out next year. So maybe we can get Jake to come out next year as well. And
get the whole clan together.
Get the whole clan together, yeah. That would be nice.
Yep.
All right. So anyways, to Q&A show. This is July, but we're going to most likely dedicate these all to annuity questions. Lord knows I got a lot of annuity questions in. But as we always do, we should wish everybody a happy July 4th. I believe this is playing on the 5th.
Yep.
So I hope you had a wonderful July 4th. Mm-hmm. And you have a great holiday weekend. I would imagine most people aren't listening over the weekend. They've got other more important things to do over July 4th. But if you are listening over the July 4th weekend, welcome. Hope things are going good. And you're enjoying the heat of summer. That's what summer's supposed to be. One of my friends in Ohio texted me today that it was 90 there. And I texted back, it's 90 here too. It's summer. It's pretty much everywhere you go, it's going to be hot. Okay, let's start with some Social Security questions, if you don't mind. I think we'll start with this one. Did he give a question? Nope, no question. He's a reader of our blog post. This came in from helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, Chris. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't give a hint. He doesn't know that. He is from the state of Georgia. He said, as I near retirement, I want to understand how my family Social Security benefits will be calculated, especially in light of the family maximum benefit, as that may affect my decision as to when I start taking my retirement benefits. My daughter currently receives SSI and SSDI. Do you need to explain what those are, you think, or not?
Probably not at this point.
Okay. Where did I leave off? SSI and SSDI. And I believe she would qualify for SSDI DAC once I retire. Disabled adult child is right. DAC, correct, Chris?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. She would qualify for SSDI, disabled adult child, once I retire, replacing SSI and her current SSDI. Starting at my retirement and not accounting for the family maximum, I believe my daughter will receive half of my primary insurance amount, and my spouse would receive half of my retirement benefit. Assuming I retire between age 63 and 67. If I understand the family maximum, the addition of all three of our benefits cannot exceed the family maximum, which according to my calculations will be 175% of my primary insurance amount. I also calculate that we would hit the family max if I wait to take my retirement benefits anytime after 65. Once at the max, I believe my benefit amount would no longer be reduced, but how will my spouse and child benefits be reduced? Will they need to each be adjusted by the same percentages? The only examples I have found are with disabled workers, where the spouse and children are split evenly. In my case, I believe my spouse and child will have a different benefit amount if I take my retirement benefits prior to age 67. Very confusing email.
Yeah, there's a couple things he's confused about, actually. It's the good news is it's a little simpler than what he's, I think, trying to wrap his mind around. First of all, he mentions that his disabled adult child would be eligible for 50% of his PIA. That statement is true. Child benefits while you're alive, if it's a minor child or a child who is disabled before 21, and considered a disabled adult child, can receive child benefits on your record once you claim, and that amount while you're living is 50%. Your spouse, as most people know, also receives 50%, but he said of his benefit, and that's not true. The spouse receives 50% of your PIA. You claiming early doesn't change your spousal benefit. He believes, clearly from the way he wrote this, that if he claims before 67, reducing his benefit, his spousal benefit is affected. That's not true. The spouse is still eligible for 50%. So both the child and the spouse are eligible for 50%. Now, the way the family maximum works, he is correct, and I can't question his 175%, because the family maximum can range anywhere between 150 and 183% of your PIA. He will just trust that his 175%, there's a formula, and so I assume he's used the formula, is his family maximum. So clearly, if he claims his PIA, which would be 100% of his PIA, and then each of his spouse and child claim 50, that would be 200%. So he's not going to get 200% coming to the household. He's going to get 175, and the way they split it is exactly like he says he read about other cases on the internet. It's split evenly because each beneficiary, you know, secondary or auxiliary beneficiary, his spouse and his child, instead of getting 50, they'll reduce them equally, and so that they're a total of 37.5. So if we cut that 175, that 75% that's available for the child and the spouse in half, it's the 37.5%. So they're going to get 37.5% each rather than 50%. Now, if his wife is claiming before her own full retirement age, the 37.5% that she'd be eligible for will be reduced because she's claiming early. I don't think he mentioned how old his spouse is, so I don't know if that would be applicable or not. So it's true they would start each at 37.5%, but she might be penalized for claiming early. There isn't a penalty for children, quote, claiming early. There's no claiming early for a child. They're eligible for their child to benefit at whatever age. And, you know, beyond 19 if they are disabled, which is the case here. So it's not being reduced because he claims early, but it could be reduced because she claims early prior to her full retirement age. So that's how that's going to work. The other thing of note is that when calculating the 175%, there is no advantage or disadvantage for him claiming before his full retirement age when he'd be eligible for his PIA. Because no matter when he claims, whether it's early prior to his full retirement age or late, you know, delayed past his full retirement age, when they're calculating the family maximum, they use his PIA for him. So just because he claims early doesn't reduce how much he's going to contribute to the 175%. He's always going to bring 100% to the party. They will always count him as 100. The question is, how much above that is available? Could be between 50 and 83% above that, that would be split by all auxiliary beneficiaries. If he had more than one child, for instance, it would be split, you know, the 75% would be split maybe three ways. But in this case, it's only split by two. Each would get 37.5%, and the wife might get something less than that if she is claiming prior to her own full retirement age. So he had some elements of it correct, I think, in his mind, but clearly was not understanding how the first, the spousal benefit works, and secondly, how his own benefit contributes to the family maximum. Always remember, if the record upon which is being claimed is yours, you're the primary that's claiming the retirement benefit that opens the door to the other benefits, the spousal and the child benefit, you are always going to count 100% towards the, in his case, 175, regardless of when you claim. Anywhere between 62 and 70, doesn't matter. You're going to, 100% is going to go against the family maximum because you're claiming. That's just the way they do it. So, a little confusing because it's a little complicated, but hopefully that cleared things up a bit for him.
Yeah, that is a very, very confusing. We get so many questions on family maximum, family benefits, mm-hmm. disabled benefits, especially through the website there, the blog post.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. I think this was the one. Okay. I have a little trouble finding this. Okay. Apparently, this has to do... I see Ed Slott being mentioned. You must have said something when I was away at an Ed Slott event, it looks. This came in May of 25. It says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. First of all, thank you for all the free information that you give to us. I have a follow-up question regarding spousal benefits as well as disabled child benefits when Jim was away at the Ed Slott conference." Oh, then he gives a hint. First, my hint. My state of residence is where the highest and lowest point of the continental U.S. are within 100 miles of each other.
Well, we learned from a previous question that the lowest point is Death Valley in California. So it's got to be California. And then, of course, what is the mountain there that's so high? It's on the tip of my tongue, but I'm going to go with California, which is the question, but I can't name the mountain off the top of my head here.
Yeah, he says California, Mount Whitney.
Whitney, yeah.
14,505 feet.
Yeah.
And Badwater Basin, 282 feet below sea level in Death Valley.
I didn't realize they were within 100 miles of each other. That's pretty crazy to have the highest and lowest within 100 miles, as you know, broad and diverse as our country is, to have those two, the max and min point, be within 100 miles is pretty crazy.
I wonder if any athlete has ever started at the bottom of this Death Valley place,
yeah.
climbed up, maybe biked the 100 miles to Mount Whitney Trailhead and hiked to the top of Mount Whitney all in one day.
Well, I don't think you could do that.
That sounds scary. Why not? Some triathlete Ironman dude could probably, or dudette could probably do it.
Yeah, maybe.
Those guys and gals are in incredible shape. Did you ever go check out the Ironman competitions here when they have them in Boulder and all over?
Oh, I know, but that's a long ways and a lot of elevation change.
But isn't that Ironman thing, don't they run a marathon?
Not with 15,000 feet of vertical.
Well, I'm not, what are you talking about 15,000 feet vertical? You don't start the trailhead at the bottom of the mountain and
no,
go up
if,
that high.
If they're starting at the bottom at 282 feet below sea level, they're going up 15,000 feet during the day.
Yeah, sure, but he'll be on a bike for 100 miles of that. Yeah. I'm just saying, I guarantee you there's somebody. I can't do it. Now, maybe two, 3 years ago.
I think somebody would have done it, and we would have heard about it if someone could do it.
If not, I challenge one of you Iron Men out there to do what I just described. Climb up from the bottom, bike the 100 miles, climb up Mount Whitney.
The challenge is you'd want to do it in the winter so you wouldn't bake in the desert, but then you couldn't go up the mountain because there'd be too much snow. And then you don't want to do it in the summer when the mountain will be nicer, but then you'll just fry when you're trying to get out of Death Valley.
Well, you would start your climb out of the bottom, not in the daylight. When you hike a 14er out here, people are generally doing it at 1, 2 in the morning, especially in August when the monsoons are here big time.
Yeah.
So they will start. So you would start in the dark with a little headlamp on, climb up, and then do your bike. So it's nice and cool in the desert at that point. I got it all planned out.
Okay.
Again, if I was a couple of years younger, I would go out there and do it. those best years of my life have gone, or I would have done this. All right, back to his question. My question is regarding myself and my autistic son. I don't have enough credit to qualify for Social Security. I was in the military for 5.5 years overseas, and I did a civilian job for 3 years. After that, I worked for the Postal Service under CSRS for 36 years. CSRS, folks, is the old government retirement system where he did not pay into Social Security. He paid into a pension plan that's phenomenal. CSRS isn't offered anymore. They now do FERS. But so he's been with the government for quite some time. With the new law, I qualify for a spousal benefit. He's talking new law, the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else. So he's talking about that. So with the new law, I qualify for a spousal benefit when my wife starts collecting this month. In the past, she probably wouldn't have received that. Now he gets it. Okay. My wife has already applied. We have not heard anything for Social Security yet. She is 64, and I am going to be 67 in July, but we also have a disabled child. I understand my son will also qualify for 50% of her benefit of around $2,700. I don't know if that's 50% of her benefit or if her benefit is $2,700.
No, that's got to be just her benefit because hers would have to be $5,400, which is not possible without delayed retirement credits.
Okay. My son is already receiving SSI of around $800 a month. My question for Chris, he was mentioning about the 150 to 180% family maximum. You just mentioned that again.
Yep.
Did you not?
A moment ago, yeah.
Okay. Chris was mentioning about the 150 to 180% family maximum allowed under one Social Security benefit. My son is 29 and has been disabled since birth. My understanding is that once my son is under Social Security for 3 years, his Medicaid will convert to Medicare, which will make it easy for him to get better health care. We would appreciate your input on the best way to navigate this decision. I have an appointment with Social Security for my benefit as well as for my son next month. Next month would have been last month for us. This came in May. We're doing this in July, so he went in June. So I apologize, listener, that it's now after the fact. But maybe Chris can add a little bit of color to what you probably already learned from Social Security.
So, a couple things. His comment about Medicaid to Medicare, I don't know for sure, honestly, as a disabled adult child receiving benefits on a retirement record, which is what they're talking about doing here, opens the door to Medicare for the child. Typically what happens that if you're on SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance, so you're on disability, once you're on disability for 2 years, you're able to sign up for Medicare regardless of your age. So that's just anyone who's on SSDI. I don't know about this three-year thing he's talking about and how that applies to a child. So I'll have to admit that I'm not sure on that one. He'd want to check to see exactly what'll happen there for his child who's been disabled since birth. When they ask kind of how to navigate the decision, the good news is I think navigating it is pretty straightforward for him. The wife appears to be claiming, they've already filed a claim for her benefit. That's going to open the door to a spousal benefit for him and a child, disabled adult child benefit for their child. Each might be eligible for up to 50% of the PIA. In this case, once again, because there's two of them, let's assume that they're, you know, let's assume their family maximum is 180%. Then instead of 50% each, he and the disabled child will each get 40% of the spouse's PIA instead. Because he's already at his full retirement age of 67, he's at or above his full retirement age, there's no reason for him to wait to claim. The previous one, right, there could have been a reason. We didn't know this, the wife's age on the previous question. Here, he says right straight up, he's already 67. So, he may as well claim the spousal benefit. He doesn't have his own Social Security benefit because he worked outside of the Social Security system. But because of the Social Security Fairness Act, GPO is gone, which would have previously prevented him from collecting a spousal benefit. Now he can get it. So there's no harm in collecting. It's going to bring more dollars into the household than if just his wife and the child claim. Because if the wife and the child claim, there's only going to be 150% coming in. And actually, since she's 64, she'll be claiming early, so her benefit's going to be reduced. So there's really no reason why he wouldn't want to claim to get some extra. He's not going to get a full 50% extra by doing that because of the family maximum, but he should be getting extra coming into the household. And there's really no downside that I can see to it. And I have no idea how the Medicaid to Medicare transition might work in that particular circumstance. So he'll have to investigate that one. So I think, you don't have to worry too much about the decision making. If your wife has in fact filed, which sounds like it has, you and your child need to both file for benefits immediately. I see no reason not to. So I think it is pretty straightforward in this case.
Perfect. Okay, I'm just looking to see. We've got a lot of annuity questions in, folks, so I'm trying to answer some old ones that go way back and some new ones. I'm trying to get to...
So at the top of the show, I might have made a false promise where I thought we were going to do less annuity questions, but maybe we'll do another show like that since we're getting caught up on annuity questions.
Oh, goodness. I'm sorry. I wasn't paying attention. I only have annuity questions pulled. So, okay.
So I take back what I said, listeners. We got some more annuity questions coming your way.
In fact, our next EDU show will most likely be a discussion on living benefits, and then right. We'll be done with that for a while. But we have received a lot of annuity questions. We received several calls to the office. I received some personal emails. Apparently, there's a lot of people with a desire for knowledge on annuities, Chris. So we may have to dedicate more time to them. What do you think?
Yeah, but we don't want to become annuities 24/7.
Yeah, we don't want to become the annuity.
There's plenty of other stuff to talk about in retirement than annuities.
Well, let me see then. I'm in the annuity folder. Let me see if I can find a new question of the week that doesn't have to do with annuities. Let me scroll back up. They're all going to be Social Security or annuities, but let me see. Bum, bum, spousal benefits, Social Security question.
Yeah, anything coming in recently is probably annuity because we've been focusing on that recently, but... So I wouldn't be shocked if there were no non-annuity questions that came in this week.
Yeah, they're all Social Security and annuity questions.
Okay, it's fine.
We had one on an HSA, and I can't find it. Don't worry, listener who sent that HSA question in. I know you sent it. I was going to confirm it with the Ed Slot group. I will get to it, but... I apologize for not being old. So looks like annuity questions, Chris, or I can keep searching
for a
non-annuity question.
That's fine.
Okay.
They'll forgive me for claiming that wouldn't happen.
All right. We got a couple of PSAs. We'll do those at a later date. So I do want to thank those listeners who sent us in some PSAs as well. Let's get to... Let's see this question. All right. This is an annuity question that came in last year. It's not necessarily annuity per se, but you guys will see. And it's one that may affect people with pensions. And that's what this gentleman was and still is, I would imagine, concerned about. He says, I am within a year or so of retiring from Ford Motor Company, and I have a defined benefit pension plan available to me. That is otherwise known as a what, Chris? Defined benefit plan?
What do you mean otherwise known as? That's what it's known as.
Say pension. Some people don't know them as defined benefits. They think of them as a pension plan.
So maybe traditional pension might be what we'd call it.
Okay. Yeah, it's a pension plan, folks. They call it defined benefit. 401ks are called defined contribution. Most people don't know them as that. They know them as 401ks. So when he says defined benefit, he's talking a traditional pension where he's going to get a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. The Ford General Retirement Plan does allow me to take either a monthly payout for the rest of my life or a lump sum. You have, in most cases, stated that taking the monthly pension is better than taking a lump sum payout. I wouldn't necessarily say Chris and I have unilaterally said it's the best thing. If people need an additional stream of lifetime guaranteed income, if they've done the calculations, if they understand our concept of secure income, our concept of minimum dignity floor, our concept of the fund number, if you do all of that and you believe in it, yes, we like a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Many pensions, dollar for dollar, pay more than a traditional annuity. I won't say they always do, but many do, because pensions are generally based on your earnings that you are getting, whereas annuities that you buy aftermarket are based on interest rates and your age.
Well, plus the insurance company needs to be making some money on the deal. And in the pension, you can think of it almost as a nonprofit that's operating, because it's operating just for the benefit of the participants. There's not the overhead of the insurance company. Now, some pension plans, especially if they're not very large, might have overhead that percentage-wise is kind of like an insurance company. But if you have a big, well-run, efficient pension plan, there's lower costs embedded because the insurance company isn't taking a cut on what's going on in the background.
Absolutely. Chris is correct. Okay. So he continues. Again, he states, I work for Ford Motor, and they are a large company, but they switched from offering a defined benefit plan to now a contributory plan, a defined contribution, otherwise known as 401k, folks, around 2004. So obviously he's been with Ford for quite some time, folks. Since that time, which going back 20 plus years, I have read articles that some corporations offload their pension obligations to insurance companies. My concern is when the pool of people that are covered by a defined benefit pension plan has diminished, the company may decide to transfer the pension to an insurance company. Let's pause there, folks, because this man is very astute. When Ford froze their pension, there's no longer younger workers paying in who are going to be paying in for 20, 30 plus years to help support the older workers that are in that pension pool. If those Ford workers live longer than average, it could start to tax, not literally, but just more euphemism, start to tax the viability and the strength of that pension plan, because people are living longer than the actuaries estimated, and there's no new dollars coming in to help support the plan. So what he's describing is a very real risk. You do run that risk. You run that risk if an insurance company was to stop offering a certain line of insurance and they say, hey, we'll honor these policies, but we're not going to sell any more. And the same thing in a frozen pension. So he's right to be concerned. It doesn't mean that the existing Ford pension plan, for those who have been grandfathered into it, is going to run into financial trouble. But I think what he's sharing, Chris, is a viable risk that one must acknowledge. Yes, no, maybe.
I think it's worth questioning it, but he may or may not find that that portion of the pension, which is now locked, the nice thing about it being locked is they know exactly who's in the pool, exactly how old they are, and they know exactly how much money is in it. And so there should be information available to him about its funding level. And if it is well funded, over 100% of its anticipated obligations, I personally wouldn't be, I think it's good to question it, but I wouldn't be particularly concerned about it. If it is not well funded, say the funding rates are 80% or something, doesn't mean it's going to collapse, but it means that they're hoping they do better than projected in order to make up the difference. Otherwise, they're going to possibly be in trouble down the road. So I would check into the funding level of the pension to see if it's worrisome. But either way, whether it's funded well or not so well, it could be sold to an insurance company. And that obviously that portion of it should be considered in, you know, your decision making.
And that's where he's going with this. Uncanny how you picked up on that, because he continues. My concern is when the pool of people that are covered by the Ford defined benefit plan has diminished, the company will transfer the pension to an insurance company. I read that several things happen at that point. The plan would no longer be covered by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. That is correct, listener. Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is a corporation that insures and backs pension plans. That corporation has another name. It's called the U.S. government. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is the U.S. government. And they have explicitly, not implicitly, explicitly said they are going to back this. I doubt they would ever default on that. The quote-unquote corporation is underfunded. I won't dispute that. And if there's a rash of defaults of pension plans in the future, there'll be trouble with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Everybody knows that. But it's also believed that the U.S. government will bail them out. Now, if the U.S. government is running into issues because of this record level of debt, which is only going to get worse now that this BBB monstrosity thing has passed, and all this other stuff in the future, that's a different fish to fry, and we're not going to be able to get there and solve it today. But I've said repeatedly on this podcast, I do feel anybody who has a reasonable 30-year remaining life expectancy and facing retirement, you most likely will experience the mother of all bond market hiccups, if you want to put it nicely, in history. That's coming. I don't know when it's going to hit, but I do feel strongly it will hit. All right, back to his question. You are correct. You will lose that backing. He is also correct with what he then says. The insurance companies that are backing the pension will be regulated by the states, and certain states have limits in coverage. There is a lack of transparency around the financial health and investment strategies of insurance companies versus pension plans. He's got two things going on in that sentence. Let's pause there. He is correct. When a corporation, which is legal to do, which I can't understand why Congress gave them the ability to take an ERISA-protected plan that is backed by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, otherwise known as the U.S. government, and pass it on to an insurance company that puts you at the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurance company, and the nightmare of 50 different, because I'm sure Ford has employees who live in multiple states now, 50 different insurance regulators, there's going to be some issues in the future that would gum this whole process up. Not to mention the protections that you get from the state guarantee funds for pension payments can be less and probably will be less than what the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation would have paid you. Because again, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is a U.S. government that has much, much deeper pockets than state governments. And ultimately, the states back the respective funds, if you will, the respected guarantee funds. I always like that euphemism they call a little Orwellian there. The first thing a state will tell you about their state guarantee fund is it's not guaranteed, but they, for some reason, love the name guarantee fund. That guarantee fund, there's no guarantee they're going to cover you, and they tell you that. So he is correct. That is a risk that if Ford was to pass that pension off, and I cannot believe Congress allows companies to do this, and they're doing it left and right. I'm just amazed because it is an ERISA-protected plan. I would just figure that they would not allow that. But he picks up on that, but then he also says that it's murky to kind of find out what the insurance company is investing in and what they're doing as opposed to the pension. The pension, because of ERISA, has to be clear and transparent with what they're doing. He is 100% correct, especially when private equity-owned insurance companies buy these pensions. One of the biggest buyers of these pensions is Athene, which is owned by Apollo Asset Management, which is a massive private equity company. And there's a lot of double dealing going on there. Everybody knows that. And that Athene is also owning some of the private equity. Athene Insurance Company owns some of the private equity debt that Athene itself is making. And then they have a lot of the stuff overseas in Bermuda and the Cayman Islands. And it just gets wholly confusing. No one can track it. I don't even think Athene can track it. Nobody knows where the money is. So he is correct. It gets hard to discover that at insurance companies. So far, Chris, I think the risks that he's saying are real. I think what you said is true. And there's no guarantee Ford is going to pass this off just because they can. And I do think someday Congress will close what I think is a loophole. They'll close this ability for companies to do that. But the cynic in me says maybe they like doing that because it takes the risk off of their shoulders, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and puts the risk on the shoulders of the state through the guarantee funds and the insurance companies.
Yeah. I'd also like to see a test court case. If one of these gets sold to an insurance company, then the insurance company fails and the pensioners get shortchanged on what they were paid. I would argue that the original employer was a fiduciary to those employees in the pension plan and put them in jeopardy by selling it and should be liable for the difference. Now I'm not a lawyer, but it just feels like it should work that way. And, the threat of
there
that.
There are lawsuits out there now, mm-hmm. Chris, not because insurance companies have failed, but because pension recipients are claiming that, similar to what you just said, you did not choose a strong insurance company. And some of those cases mm-hmm. are allowed to go forward. Others have been thrown out. So
until they're
no
actually
idea,
harmed, they probably don't have much of an argument. There has to be harm, I think.
True. But even if someone is harmed in the future, yeah. How long is that going to go through the courts?
Yeah,
that's just it. These people may be dead by time a quote-unquote settlement is reached, if ever.
Yeah. This so, seems anyways, like something back, Congress should deal with for sure.
Back to what he's saying. Do you think any of this could be a valid concern in the future? Yes, everything that you have shared is a valid concern. I'm not going to whitewash it. It is. I don't know what the future is going to bring, but it is a valid concern. Should I consider the lump sum distribution instead of taking a monthly pension? It's hard for us over a podcast to answer that, listener. Mm-hmm. A lot's going to depend on how much secure income you need. As Chris said, the funding of the Ford pension itself, how strong it is. Has Ford, I don't know, but has Ford said they would never do this? Have they given any direction of where they might go? And granted, just because they said they would never do it doesn't mean they couldn't do it in the future. But if you need additional lifetime income, not until the future, kind of look at what you're going to get in a pension lump sum payout and compare it to what you could get in an annuity today and in an annuity tomorrow, meaning well into the future. And it might make sense. We have seen that, have we not, Chris? Where, hey, you know what? It does make sense to take this pension. Mm-hmm. And if it can grow at a certain rate, and we have to do calculations to figure that out, you could end up with more money in the future than what you're going to get from this pension, and you can buy it from an A++ rated insurance carrier.
Yeah, the second part is the biggest argument to consider if you're worried about this situation. If you take the money, at least then you get to decide what insurance company you want to have a relationship with. You get that control. You take that, whereas leaving it at the pension, if they sell it, which is an if, they're the ones going to decide what insurance company it goes to. And I would hope that they would behave responsibly and pick a very strong insurance company. But you don't have that control. If you took it, you'd have that control. So, I mean, there's a lot of these things you should weigh and decide what you're most concerned about. And nobody knows what's going to happen, but I guess this might fall into the minimize your maximum regret kind of a category, that if they sold it off, the scariest thing to you is them selling it off to an insurance company. If that's the one outcome that would bother you the most, then you might want to consider taking an action that would avoid that, which would be taking control of your own dollars.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. So I would look at what they're going to offer you and compare that to what you can get with a pension today. And if they're reasonably close, I could see you, even if you don't need it today, take the lump sum. And when I say reasonably close, I mean, if you're going to get 40% more in the pension, that's not reasonably close. If you're going to get 8, 9, 10% more in the pension than you could get an annuity on your own, that's reasonably close. You could take that money, earmark it, dedicate it towards a future income need, invest it based on when you think you might experience that need. So if it's still 12, 15 plus years from now, you might take a more growth-oriented approach. And I would wager, Chris, that account would probably grow large enough to provide the amount of income that they need in the future, or a portion of it, and he wouldn't have this pension sale risk that he fears.
True. At least he'd have his own. But you are taking on some of the burden of performance by doing that, right? Because leaving it in the pension, the pension's doing it all for you. They've promised you the formula, and the formula is what it is. You take it out and you are going to do something with it for 10 or 15 years. Good or bad things could happen during that 10 or 15 years. So there's a different kind of risk there.
Absolutely. There's no free lunch. There's going to be a trade-off with everything. Mm-hmm. But I do like your statement that he gets to choose the insurance company now, not Ford.
Yeah.
And they might choose an insurance company that he doesn't really particularly care for.
Right.
It would allow him to make that choice.
Yeah. Now, sometimes if they're attractive to you, a lot of these big pensions have claiming options that you can't get with an annuity. So there is some flexibility there. They have features like pop-up provisions and things that aren't common in the insurance world, where if your spouse predeceases you, your benefit pops up to what it would have been for just one of you. And some of those things exist in some of these bigger pensions. So you'll want to look at all those things to make sure you're weighing all the variables and make sure you're not giving up something that you might particularly value if you have a particular benefit structure that you prefer that's only available in your pension.
All righty. Let's get to the last question and we'll wrap up this holiday show. He gives a hint to you that he claims is an easy state hint.
Okay.
I live in the state where a young George Washington blundered in starting the French and Indian War. I don't quite think George Washington started it. Some historians claim he did, but he definitely led to it.
I don't know. This is going to be a guess for me. Pennsylvania.
Yes. Wow. You pulled that out of nowhere. Or did you know it?
No, I didn't. That was a guess. I'm thinking, that time period is you know, where would he likely be geographically? And it just seemed, plus that's a fairly big area. I was also thinking of something like Vermont or something, but I thought, boy, that's really small. At least Pennsylvania's big. So, you know, geographically, so I have a better chance he might have physically been there. So that was my thought process. So I got lucky on that one.
Wow, excellent. All right. This one is an investment question and an annuity question. Mm-hmm. Chris may have a different opinion. I'll let him provide his own answer. All of you VGers, y'all might have your own opinion. I'll give my opinion. So this isn't going to be more of a specific question, just going to be opinions. But here's what he says. Can you render an opinion on the following option that I have in my employer 401k? I have an investment option called a managed payout, meaning as I deposit money into this single fund, it will annually calculate a payout rate that could be more or less than 5%, and I will receive it monthly. For instance, if I put $400,000 into this fund, and based on a drawdown that will include a return of my principal, interest, dividends, so a little bit of everything, folks, from this payout fund. I'm sure you all have heard of these. I could receive $20,000 a year that will be paid to me as $1,667 a month. The fund aims for this to last 30 years. I understand this is a goal of the fund. It is not a guarantee. Every September, the fund will calculate the following year's payout based on the performance of the fund, and they state their payments can go up or go down, albeit slightly. He does not define slightly, Chris. Once payments start, I cannot turn them off. But I can sell shares in the fund and leave the payout fund entirely. I have accounts at Charles Schwab. They offer a similar service where they will manage the account with a group of ETFs and manage my payout. However, Schwab does offer me the flexibility to turn my payout on and off. The 401k does not. My wife is very annuity adverse. I guess too many Ken Fisher commercials. And I thought this may be a way to generate a long-term predictable cash flow. I have an issue with that word, predictable. Predictable cash flow. Plus, we still have upside potential, and it is liquid, and I can sell it. Have you ever recommended secure income products like this? I am a do-it-yourselfer, and this seems like a great option for me to design my own paycheck without me having to do the regular calculations and withdrawals. So far, so good, Chris.
Yeah, I think I follow.
Okay. Managed payout funds really started under Vanguard. I think they were the first that started them. I don't know how successful Vanguards are. I've never been a fan of them as covering secure income because of my definition of secure income. My definition of secure income is, again, first, it is predictable and known. There is no ambiguity. If secure income changes at all, it can only go up. He fails on that first one. He gets part of it. He knows what his first payment's going to be. But every September, based on the performance of this fund, he might get more, he might get less, albeit, quote unquote, slightly. There's no definition of what slight is. A 10% drop might be slight. A 30% drop might be slight. It depends what they're referencing it to. I firmly believe that secure income, if he's using this to fund minimum dignity floor expenses, And minimum dignity floor expenses only go up as time goes on. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. If he's trying to cover his minimum dignity floor and he has a, I couldn't even say a lifetime stream. This is quote unquote intended to last 30 years. It might only last 25, 22. Maybe it goes 31. There's no surety it's going to last the rest of his life, and there's no surety it won't drop in value, that the payouts drop in value. Because minimum dignity floor expenses always go up, you need a source of income that's never going to drop, or preferably if it moves at all, it only goes up, contractually guaranteed. There is no contractual guarantee in these products. So I don't think it's a viable source of secure income based on my definition. Now, that said, can it be beneficial, as he said, to simplify if he's going to do withdrawals? And if you feel the fee, you didn't tell me what the fee of this fund inside the 401k was, I would compare that fee to the fund inside the 401k to what Vanguard charges on their managed payout funds. I don't expect it to be as low as Vanguard's, but let's say Vanguard's is 7 bips, 7 basis points, 0.07. And this is 0.52. I'm just making these numbers up. You can at least show it to your 401k provider, the board, not the custodian who's holding it. They don't give a damn. Go to whoever the sponsor of the 401k is, go to their retirement board, the fiduciaries who oversee that, and it's their responsibility to put efficient investments in there, appropriate, efficient. Doesn't mean the lowest cost, but if there's a big disparity between what a Vanguard option might charge and what they're charging, you might be able to get them to replace this fund or negotiate a lower fee. That's the only place I'm going with this.
One of the Vanguard managed funds is 27 basis points. I'm looking at it right now. Not necessarily in their 401k, but the externally available in your own brokerage account version is 27 basis points, the one I'm looking at. I just wanted to check one of them to see what it was like.
Perfect. So if the one inside your 401k is 30 or 35, even 40, I think they're close. And if it's lower than 27, it's really good fee-wise. If it's comparable to Vanguard, if it's 60, 70, 80, 90 plus basis points, it might be rather expensive for what you're getting. Keep that in mind. Every basis point that they're taking is a basis point less of payout to you. Keep that in mind. So you don't share anything about the fee of the fund, but assuming the fund fee is reasonable. A couple other things before I let Chris get into this. 401ks, I don't know what the payout percentage is, but 401ks cannot be used to offset RMDs from IRAs or other 401ks. If this payout that you're going to receive, remember, when RMDs begin, when you're 73 or depending on your age, it could be 75, the initial payout is about 3.7% right now. If this fund is intended to pay out 5 plus or minus, there's more coming out of this fund than needs to as far as an RMD goes, which is not a bad thing. Don't get me wrong, listener. But if the money was inside an IRA, that extra, let's just assume the payment is 5%. The extra 1.3%, and you're putting 400,000 into this. What's 1.3 of 400,000, Chris? 4,000, 4.5, 4.8? What does it come to?
1.3% of 400,000? 5,200, I think. So 400,000.
Okay. I wasn't even close. 5,200 extra is coming out in year one. Under secure, well, this isn't even an annuity, so it has nothing to do with secure two. Under the law, that 5,200 could be used to offset $5,200 of RMD from another IRA you may have. Hopefully you follow that logic, listener. Your initial RMD is going to be about 3.7. This, if it pays out 5, is paying you 1.3 more. If it's inside that employer's 401k, it cannot be used against any other 401ks you have. It cannot be used to reduce the RMDs of your IRA. You must be able to move it. Where am I going with this? Most 401ks do not allow for the transfer. In fact, all do not allow for the transfer of the actual asset. They transfer cash. So I don't know, once you retire and RMDs begin, if from a tax planning perspective, this is reasonable or not. If you need the money and you are going to take it out, okay, it's probably reasonable. But if you don't need the money and you want that flexibility of not having to take it out of the IRA if you don't need it, that 401k is not going to help you. The excess money that you're getting, if they're striving for 5, isn't going to help you. Now, with that whole tirade, generally when you get into your mid to late 80s, that will turn. And your RMD is going to be greater than 5%. It'll start approaching 6%+. So at some point in time, the payout from this account, this investment, will not satisfy your RMDs, and you'll have to make it up. Again, if you have it all in a 401k, you'll have to take that money out of that 401k. My question would be, how is the 401k going to treat this if the distribution and the only investment you have in that 401k is this investment? And it's paying less than what your RMD is. It's not an annuity, so the IRS doesn't give a damn. They're going to want more coming out. So you need to find out, how does selling shares of this to generate additional dollars for the RMD? I don't think there's going to be a penalty or a reduction of your income, short of you have fewer and fewer shares paying this distribution. I'm hoping what I'm describing makes sense, but if you listen to it a few times, it will. If you have other money inside that 401k, as you get into your 80s, you can take money from those investments and make up the missing RMD. But as one listener just pointed out to us, Chris, many 401ks will pro rata sell across all of your investments. So you might start to run into issues in your 80s with complexity solving RMDs from this 401k holding. Whereas if it was in an IRA, it would be a whole hell of a lot easier. So I'm just sharing with you pros and cons, not what you were probably hoping of. Do you like these funds for secure income? No, it doesn't meet my definition. For simplicity, yeah, it's okay, but it's not true secure income by my definition. I'm looking at all these other headaches you're going to be faced with: IRAs, 401ks, aggregation rules, RMDs in the future not being covered by this distribution fund, and you have to make up for it with other assets inside your 401k. Pro rata selling of those assets inside the 401k, you might be making a lot of complexity by owning this that you're not thinking of. Long answer.
Yeah.
What do you think,
Chris? And let's say it goes 30 years and you're still alive. Now you're in your 80s, 90s, and your income source that you'd been relying upon has stopped, and now you have to figure something else out. Is that the time? It's essentially the younger you setting up a mess for the older you, which is the opposite of what we promote. The younger you should be taking steps to ease the life of the older you, make the decisions fewer in quantity and more simple to be made for the older you. The younger you has an obligation to take care of the older you. And you need to take steps to do so. People get so stuck on, you know, thinking about things in their mind as of today. Things are going to be very different 20 or 30 years from now. Now, if you're gone, doesn't matter. But if you, you know, live beyond the target length of this, the horizon of this particular fund, compared to an annuity, which would still be paying you, and dollar for dollar, the annuity is going to pay out more than what this plan distribution is. Now, this type of fund has, because of market performance, could certainly have a version of inflation protection in it as it, you know, could possibly grow with market conditions, where a traditional annuity without an inflation adjustment on it, it's going to be flat, but it's going to start out a lot bigger. So, you know, that's the trade-off. If, you know, it sounds like your wife maybe would never consider an annuity, so maybe that's not even on the menu, but you should be comparing these things and also thinking about the complexity you might be leaving for the older you.
Yeah, very good points. Excellent points. So there's a lot of moving parts to this. See, it seems like a simple question, doesn't it, listener? And you thought it was all about the investment part. There's all of these. I think it's just going to be a complex product in the future because 401ks cannot be aggregated with IRAs. They cannot be aggregated with other 401ks. Making up the distributions when there's not enough coming out of that account to cover the RMDs is going to be difficult because the way 401ks often pro rata the sales earlier, you're not going to get a benefit for when this payout is greater than 3.7, the starting RMD value. So there's a lot to make me say, you're not winning me over. Not to mention what Chris rightly points out, and I think you rightly acknowledge, it's not guaranteed. There's no contractual guarantee. You are not passing the risk on to a third party. You're passing the management and the risk of sequence of returns on to a third party, but a third party that can just shrug his shoulders and say, we tried, we gave it our best, but my God, did you see what the bond market did? Did you see what the stock market did? Didn't see that coming. Sorry, there's no money left. Insurance companies can't say that to you. They have to keep paying you. Now, as the other listener wrote and we acknowledged, you run into issues with insurance companies going insolvent. So we tend to only favor A++ rated carriers for lifetime streams of guaranteed income. And hopefully those insurance companies don't run into issues. But as I've often said, if the U.S. government is defaulting, if the insurance companies, large A++ rated insurance companies are defaulting, everything else is going to hell in a handbasket already if those entities are going under. And at that point, there's nothing I can do and you can do. And we'll just deal with it if it happens. But I don't want people to dwell on that. Dwell on the more likely outcome. And the more likely outcome is that this product doesn't last 30 years. And now you're 89, 92, 94, and a massive part of your income is gone. That's a tough pill to swallow. That's why if it's covering minimum dignity for food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, they should be covered with a stream of income that's backed by a deep-pocketed third party who has pooled the risk with thousands and thousands of other investors. And one of the good things about annuities, especially an annuitized annuity listener and listeners, there's no pulling your money out. People can pull their money out of that product. If the shit hits the fan, excuse my French, in the future, and people start pulling their money out, that liquidity feature is an albatross around the neck of the manager. And your income could be dropping like bricks because he or she has to start selling and selling things that are down to meet liquidity calls if it's truly that liquid, as you indicated. So you expose yourself to all of that. At least with a single premium immediate annuity, it's up to the insurance company to hopefully be managing that risk well with reinsurance, co-insurance, wise bond purchases, and a well-managed, highly rated company will do all that, and maybe they can weather the storm quite fine. But the people inside that annuity cannot pull out and force the insurance company to start selling assets that are down.
That's a good point.
Whereas in this product, they can, and it could hurt you more.
Yep.
So got to say, I'm not a fan, listeners. Now that said, what's great, you all are geeks on this. If people disagree with me, please share why. And don't rip me a new one. Just share why. Hey, I disagree. I have these, and here's why. And here's why I disagree with what you say. Chris and I, and I'm sure this listener would appreciate it. I think that would be pretty good. If you do agree with me, right, tell me that as well. But you might have one of these funds now, and it might be working great for you. Don't write to me and tell me that. I'm not opining on right now, hey, they worked out great since they've been out. It's what can the future bring when this listener is in his late 80s, 90s. That's what I worry about.
Yeah. Good point. Interesting one. I don't think we've talked about those before. So.
Oh, so see, there's kind of a non-annuity question that was tied to annuities.
True, true. So want to thank everybody for sending in the questions. If you want to send in your own questions, send them to Jim directly. Jim at jimhelps.com is the email. It's jimhelps.com. And in the subject line, put that it's a question for the podcast and include a word or two about the subject. We appreciate everybody continuing to listen and hope you had a safe and enjoyable 4th of July, since this releases immediately after that. Jim, I hope you do get to have your hike. I think that sounds actually kind of nice, other than getting up at 4:30 in the morning.
Let me say one thing, though. I didn't realize this guy sent this question literally almost a year ago.
Oh.
So sorry, listener, it took so long to get to. He sent it August 13th. Hmm.
Well, these funds still exist, so it's still a pertinent question.
True.
So Jim, you have a nice weekend, and everyone else, stay safe, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.